So at least once a week, I find a story out of somewhere that I see, and I'm like, there's a story there. I get triggered, and the writer brain takes off, building scene after scene, while my rational mind sits back, waits for a break in the action to easily point out that in the real world, there is zero time for me to entertain this story. So instead of slipping down a rabbit hole and losing a day of writing on my current project, I copy the link and drop it into my ideas file on my phone, for hopefully to come back to at a later date. And I ran into one of these stories earlier this week. And after the sudden tornado of plot ideas and scenes just took off in my head, I had an idea. I thought, what if I offer some of these up to you guys? Some of you, however many of you out there are listening to this podcast, are either in between books or looking for an idea for a first book. So what I was kind of thinking is maybe I toss some of the things out here, some of those stories that trigger my writer brain, and maybe it sends you down your own rabbit hole to work on your next project, or maybe even kick you off on writing your first novel. So tonight I'm going to give that a shot. In the UK, I found this. This is out of the Sentinel or the Telegraph. But there's a draft proposal out of the World Health Organization for a pandemic preparedness treaty. Doesn't sound that bad, right? On its face, it doesn't sound so bad. Why not collaborate on a global scale to hedge off the next microbial boogeyman that's going to scare us all to death, right? But part of this treaty that was in the fine print would require all signees, all states, to recognize and follow WHO guidance during a public health emergency. This includes lockdowns and distribution of medicine. So in the article, it discusses a potential vote in the UK, a vote to allow a group of unelected bureaucrats to not only dictate your people's freedom of movement and assembly, but to decide who gets medicine and in what order. So I don't know if your brain works the same as me, but for the moment, let's forget about the corruption, the aspects of the corrupted aspects of entities like the UN or the WHO, or the political winds and money that drive these agencies' policy. But what got me was that a country was actually considering this enough to bring it to a vote. These people are considering allowing faceless suits to dictate a populace's natural right of assembly with zero accountability and zero ability to protest these actions. So given, looking at this as a historical perspective over the last couple of years, which you all suffered through, just looking at how much some of our own elected leaders seem to really get off on controlling their populations and absolutely stomping on rights during COVID, I went pretty dystopian pretty fast when I read this article, and you can imagine how my brain works, and you've read my books, and just seeing all the scenes and all the plot twists, that just went crazy in my brain. So I copied the link out, put it in my ideas file, and then quickly went and cleaned and function checked all my guns. Just kidding. I didn't take it that far. I didn't act. My guns work and they're always clean, but I didn't do that. I didn't stop and start preparing. But something like that triggered me. I was wondering, maybe that's something that can trigger you. Maybe if I'm going to drop this link into the show notes, maybe it's something that'll kick you off on your next project. Maybe it's something that will kick off your first book. And if you do so, hit me up, drop me an email, john@johnstampwriter.com. I want to read it, of course. Also, comment in the notes section of the show if you like this idea. If you do, maybe I'll drop more in the future, the next dystopian story out of the UK that happens to trigger my writer's brain. But there, I'm trying. I had a new idea, wanted to try it on you guys. I really hope that somebody out there, one of you guys gets this, and as I'm speaking, you're hitting pause and your notebook is getting filled with crazy ideas of how to stop faceless bureaucrats from stomping on your constitutional freedoms. If you do, I want to know about it. That's it. Tonight, I'm talking to James Rozon again. He was just on a few weeks back, And while he was on, we started talking about writing his therapy and how it helped him out with a few things during his time, and actually how it kicked off his pretty amazing career. At the end, we got into this at the end of the interview, and when we wrapped, we were chatting afterwards, and we both decided that this topic needs more time. There's a lot of good that can come of discussing the benefits, just the catharsis alone of writing his therapy. So I'm going to welcome James back. James, thanks again for coming on.
Thanks for having me back and talking about this important discussion and this topic. Dystopian idea, not bad. There's a writer, A.G. Riddle, wrote a series a little while back called The Extinction Files. Highly recommend checking that out if you want to go down that route. But yeah, it's
Might
a
be
scary
related.
that people would think that's a good idea.
Oh, I read that and I was just like, you can already see it. The playbook's already been written. It's going to be how scary, they're going to paint this really scary picture. The world's coming in. They already have, what is it, like Virus X out there that they're saying is going to be the next pandemic and freak everybody out.
It's all
And
about
boom.
control.
So,
It's all
yeah,
about
everybody's
control.
good. We're going to give a global entity that's not elected and has no statutory rights the ability to tell us to stay home. That goes nowhere good. Just,
No, I
just,
can't see a lot of governors in the U.S. just abiding by that.
I can think of two
Well, yeah,
that would probably
two.
really like it. And I think probably everybody can probably know exactly where I think on the West End in the middle of our country can probably understand who I'm talking about. But yeah, the rest of them would be like, you're out of your freaking mind. But we'll
Yeah,
see.
I like where I live. I'm in a state that grows a lot of oranges and has wonderful beaches, so I'll kind of leave the hints there. But we call ourselves a free state of something for a reason.
Right. Yeah. I believe I'm in the right part of the country for some, at least my governor would give those people the middle finger if they try to here.
Good.
So I'm good with that. But no, I hope somebody, that might be a great idea to kick somebody off. I hope that works out for somebody. But yeah, last time you were on, and I'm going to mention, but I already mentioned Into the Battle. We're going to talk about your books because I just finished an amazing scene that you wrote and I want to tell you about it. But we were talking about the healing properties of writing and kind of how you got into it. And you mentioned briefly about you dealing with PTSD and how once somebody just gave you the idea and it just kicked off everything you do now. So if you would, I know it's kind of personal, but if you would walk into how you your journey with PTSD and how writing just has helped amongst as an alternative to other therapies that you've tried.
A lot of veterans suffer silently with this, okay? Because our culture, way we've been brought up, and even inside the military, all that stuff is essentially treated like weakness. You're being weak. You're not tough enough for this. You're not doing this or that. The fact is, it's not weakness to admit you have a problem or that there's something going on in your head or that you are having a difficulty processing something. It is not normal to see a bunch of your friends get brutally killed and mutilated. It's not normal to have rocket attacks happening at your house, around your neighborhood and things going on like that. It's not normal for vehicles that are in front of you to just explode when they hit an IED. War changes people, and it introduces a lot of nastiness, okay? War is what it is. It's about killing the enemy and destroying their will to fight as fast as you can to end the war. And we signed up for that. We volunteered for this. Nobody drafted us. But that doesn't mean it doesn't impact us and leave some lifelong scars and problems for us to overcome. I've told people in the past, my job when I was over there, I was an interrogator. So the down and dirty job. I'm the guy who sits there with these Al-Qaeda operatives that we captured or former regime element guys, and I have to try and get information out of this person with one arm tied behind my back and a set of rules that are designed to give them a little more protections and shielding than me, trying to get the intel so we can go nab the next cell before they can carry out their attack, or figure out how to dry up their finances, or where, how are the weapons coming in? How do we interdict that kind of stuff? There's so many facets and things you have to go after and do. And every prisoner is going to offer you an opportunity in one or two of those lanes. And you got to try to figure out how you're going to do it. So that's tough, because these are savages. You know, you got some guy just, you know, brutally murdered, whether it was civilians or, you know, sometimes coalition soldiers getting killed. And you just somehow have to go in there and find a way to get information out of them without, like, torturing them or coercive techniques that are forbidden. That's tough. That's really tough. It requires a level of thinking and conniving that is just not normal. And interrogator, because of BS, fictitious narratives that were being written about by people who had observed the interrogation but didn't actually participate in it, and he didn't do anything wrong, but it was the perception of something wrong in light of Abu Ghraib and what had happened a couple of years prior. So it was way overreaction in how they handled him. And that was a real gut punch to all the rest of us, because we're there just trying to do our jobs. And now we don't have, like, support of our management. We didn't really call them leadership. We just called them management.
Right.
And that was hard. That sucked, because you're under a lot of scrutiny. I mean, our interrogations have to be signed off by your NCOIC, your OIC. He was signed off by the behavioral psychologist, you know, so there's a colonel or a light colonel that's going to be there doing that. Make sure you're doing what type of approaches and techniques you're doing. And then legal, you know, you got to go have JAG sign off on that too. So we always had a JAG officer there. Typically it was Navy. Navy used to provide the JAGs for us. And they all have to sign off on that. And your interrogations are being recorded and, you know, videoed and monitored. So there's sometimes some of the JAGs are monitoring it, or the behavioral psychology guys, which is called the Biscuit. So that group would sometimes doing that, or outside agencies and groups could listen in if they had permission to, just to make sure that you're not crossing the line. And that's stressful, man. You know, we just want information. I'm not there to prosecute him. I'm just there to get intel to go the next mission.
Yeah, but the willingness that I saw sometimes for commands to eat their own without the benefit of the doubt, they'd just be like, all right, you know, send them, be honest, whatever. We got an allegation, cut them. It's like, are you kidding me? What does this do to this kid? But but just when you talk about the stress that builds, and then you come home and there's such a structure there. I feel for him. I really do.
I explained it, like, in the book. I explained how when my last day in Iraq, okay, our unit was flying back, and I think it was like 14 of us were gonna have to catch the next ride the next day. And so I drew short stick and had to stay behind one extra night. And they, like, were rocketing the hell out of our base and hitting us pretty good that night. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, man, you know, I could get blown up and I'm less than a few hours from getting out of this.
Of all the times.
And then we get back down there and we get down to Kuwait, you know, that next morning. We're there during the day. They had already started a lot of the process before, you know, because we were coming late. And we flew back. I was only in Kuwait, I want to say 24 hours, and then was flown back home to the States. So within 72 to 96 hours, it was probably about 96 hours of that incident happening on the FOB. So now I'm walking around the mall with my wife. That's hard to compute. You know, I always had a sidearm with me, or my rifle, or both. I didn't have any of that. Didn't have, you know, all that protection, all that, anything. And so it was a tough adjustment to make, you know, and you don't always see what that's doing to you or recognize what that's doing to you, but your family does, and your reactions, because doing that job, that's not something you just turn off instantly. You know, you find yourself, you know, doing combative, like, word salads with people. You know, I had to go to a psychological evaluation when I got back, because they always ask the question, did you see dead people? It's like, yes. You see, you know, you know, American dead or civilians and things like that? And, you know, I answer yes for all those questions. And so then they make you go see a psych after that. And that whole first hour interview with her, I mean, I turned the whole thing around to where I was questioning her and getting her to tell me what she thought of working here and how she liked working with veterans, how she liked doing this, because she was a civilian contractor, you know, coming over. So she would, you know, I had this whole thing turned back around on her. And she didn't quite catch that or realize
how good defense.
Entire thing off of me and shifted it over to her because I didn't want to talk about me.
Yeah.
And the next time we met, she's like, so I want to talk about last time. I recognize what you did. So we have to talk about that because that's not how this works. You're not supposed to be talking and analyzing me. I'm supposed to make sure you're still fit for duty and things like that. Like, well, clearly I am because I just managed to do this to you.
Yeah, you're interrogating an interrogator. What are you thinking?
Yeah, exactly. So, but that's the problem because that is not a good way to interact with your wife, your kids, your employers, your coworkers, because nobody likes that happening to them or seeing that happen. And I don't know. I got really frustrated with a lot of this stuff. You know, I lost a couple of jobs because. You know, I just, there was a right way to go about doing the type of stuff I was doing overseas. And then there's people back here in, you know, DC and whatever who think it should be done this other way. And it's like, well, I'm the dude in the field. I'm the one over here doing this stuff, working with all the local nationals and talking with the people in these different countries. I kind of have an idea of what's going on, how this works. You're telling me from your ivory tower that I should be doing it this way. Well, that way doesn't work, you know? So it creates a friction problem, you know? And at some point you start asking yourself, you know, what is this all about? Is this worth anything, you know, anymore? Because you don't fit anywhere. You don't fit in anywhere. You're not, like, I don't want to say welcomed, but you're not appreciated or wanted, so to speak. And you know, I've had more of my friends kill themselves since coming back from the war than died in the war. You know, you just eventually lose that battle of the mind, the will to live, the feelings of you're actually contributing and doing something. You can support yourself and your family. Because I'm telling you, as a man, when you start losing jobs, like high-paying jobs, okay, you know, I got a graduate degree, I got a ton of experience, you know, can I get jobs, you know, $140,000, $180,000 a year? These are not low-paying jobs. You start losing some of these positions because you're too abrasive or just manipulative. And people don't like that. It's something you've been trained to do. You're highly efficient at your job and what you do. You're just not the easiest person to work with or work around, so to speak. That sucks. That gets really hard because then you start losing this job and you start losing another job. And eventually you start in this cycle where it's very difficult to find employment. And you start saying, I'm worth more dead than alive. Got an insurance policy. It's past its suicide clause there. So if I do this, at least my family gets cashed out, you know, $500,000 or whatever, pays off the house and they've got some money. My wife will find a better man that will treat her and the kids better than I am or I was.
The snowball, the just snowball of it just.
And then you start thinking about that over and over until you start putting plans in place and start figuring out when, you know, and trying to make sure you have, you know, give them a couple of good days or good weeks. So that way, when you do it, their immediate memories of you are all good stuff and not bad stuff, you know. But that's kind of tough. That's when I personally kind of settled in and said, I got to find some help and figure something out because, you know, we had two kids. We just had our second kid at that time. And, you know, I had everything all planned out. What I was going to do and how I was going to do it. And I just fell asleep. I fell asleep waiting for them to, waiting for my wife and two little ones to knock out before I would do what I was going to do. I was just take, you know, I wasn't going to use a gun or anything. I just used pills. I had mapped it all out. I gotten that far along in the process of doing that. And that's when I said, I gotta do something different and find some help. So I started talking with the VA. And you know, they have this CBT, cognitive processing therapy. That is awful. I'm telling you. And you write out the situations and all these things over and over and over again. I was like, all right, listen, I can't do that. I'm going to kill myself before I finish my way through this thing. What else can we do? So she was like, well, write a book. I was like, okay, well, what am I going to write about? And she had this question. She's like, well, what kind of books do you want to read that are not being written? And that put me, that got my head to thinking. And suddenly I was like, ah, here's what I like, but nobody writes this. So I started writing the very kinds and types of books I want to read that nobody else is doing. And so I started doing that. She thinks she's sending me down a rabbit hole to just work on a project for a long time, and that this will hopefully help
just distract you, if nothing else.
Yeah. And unbeknownst to her, it put me down an entirely different career path, because I started thinking about that, looked up on Amazon, I could do this, started putting it all together. I bootstrapped the thing. I had no editor. Just my wife is, she's got a graduate degree as well. And she used to work as a Spanish teacher. And so she was really good with second language and how to do the grammar and punctuation. So she helped with a lot of that, but it was a risk. We put it up 2015 and we launched our first book, and I was shocked. People started to actually buy this thing.
And it's awesome.
My first month, I think I made like $86 or something. People actually bought this thing.
That's more than most authors make in a career. So
I know. Well, it started to grow, and then it started making a couple hundred. But then when it actually made 1,000, at the time I was unemployed when I was writing. So like this was real money. This was money that was actually helping. I was like, okay, this could really work. So I continued to work on creating more of the books, and it just kind of took off from there. It just kind of accelerated, and I continued to focus on writing the kinds of books I want to write, because I want to read, because I like some of those, like Tom Clancy's Red Storm Rising, the really big battles. I like that, but nobody really writes that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started focusing on writing those kinds and styles of books. And what really took off for us was my last corporate job I had. I was working as a VP over at Aon Insurance, a cyber professional risk broker. And I had an hour and 45 minute commute one way, hour and 45 minute back, and 8 hours at the job. So I'm working 12 hour shifts, basically. I said, you know what? If I work 12 hour shifts writing books and stories, I'll bet you I could probably write quite a few of these books a year and make this work. So I started doing that. And, I said, well, what am I going to do? So I looked at, this is 2016 going into 17. I was like, all right, so what are going to be the most likely conflicts between over the next 10 to 15 years? And I said, Ukraine, Korea, Taiwan, Pacific, and some stuff between Russia and China. I was like, well, how do I combine that and make that a big series? And so we developed this whole Red Storm theory and idea of, the Chinese and the Russians working together and using their proxies with Iran and Korea as, cannon fodder type stuff. And we started putting that whole thing out together with Battlefield Ukraine and Battlefield Korea. Those things took off. And once that stuff took off, we said, we're doing this. We're all in on this. So my wife
kind of working prophetic at this point.
Yeah, but she stopped working her nursing job.
Oh, that's awesome.
She could help me in with this so we could keep turning them out. And as we were making more money, we started to really professionalize the business then, having a really, really good high-end editor. They do cost a lot of money to edit, but you never catch everything, by the way, okay, but you catch most of it.
No matter what. So do you, as you were talking, the counselor says, write a book that you would want to read.
Yeah.
And as you said, that you thought that she's just trying to distract you and maybe time heals all wounds type thing. But as you're talking, I'm seeing, we went from you discussing losing job two and getting that spiral towards self-harm. And then you see light through the book. Do you think it was a matter of purpose? Their writing and the success found purpose and reinstilled that in your path, or was there a catharsis in the writing that also helped with the PTSD itself?
I think it was both, but a big part of it is I suddenly was able to have, I suddenly felt like I had some value. Like I could actually contribute and have some value and help the family, whereas I wasn't before. I was negative, kind of hostile, you know, closed off, then losing jobs, so then not even being able to provide for the family. And, you know, as a man, it just sucks. It just sucks when it starts happening and you're in the death spiral like that. And you're like, how do I get out of this? Because it just builds and builds and builds and it makes it so it's just doom and gloom. And, but suddenly I had a purpose. This writing stuff became the purpose, like writing the next book, getting the next one out, you know, wrapping these things up together and tying it all into one really awesome series. That became the purpose because now I had to use my thinking cap and my brain to go, okay, how am I actually going to do all of this? Right. What's the strategy and plot involved? So I went back to thinking, doing all the, you know, identity intelligence work and stuff I'd done in the past where you're always targeting adversaries. All right, well, how do I attack this problem in essentially the same way? How do I build that path and that target like that? It gave me a sense of purpose, but more than that, I started making pretty good money at this, which meant I was able to start providing for my family and actually, you know, pay the mortgage with the sales from books, buy food, pay car insurance, you know, work, you know, pay some of my student loan off, you know, just I was able to start living and being able to do normal things and realize that, hey, I don't need a job from someone else. I don't need someone else to provide that. I can provide that myself by leveraging, you know, in this case at the time, leveraging Amazon's KDP platform and doing this. And that was a game changer because I was now getting that working, but it wasn't the end of the road either because I still had a lot of the unresolved problems and challenges. But now I had the time to actually work on them. And I started to have a little more financial means to actually work on them and address them outside the VA because the VA is constrained by what they're allowed to do and not allowed.
And at the, I tell my kids this all the time, because I have my guys are extremely creative. They're always coming up with their stories and we'll talk about it. And it's the same thing. I just, the idea that all the profit, every bit of profit and everything you can put towards family, put towards obligations, that all comes out of one idea that just popped in your head. And I equate this to Lucas. You know, my guys are huge Star Wars fans. And I'm like, George Lucas, everything he has came from a dumb idea that he had in his head when he was in college, and he built an literal empire with it. So the feeling that must come with that, and then it, you know, that builds into purpose and drive, stability, and then you can focus on the deeper stuff that you need to handle.
One of the things I saw a 60-minute special that they did with Dakota Myers. He got the Medal of Honor in Afghanistan. And he was talking about this this treatment called a stellate ganglion blocker, SGB. The VA is actually now starting to do some work in that area too. And I was listening to him talk and watched the interview. I was like, that looks like it could possibly work. And so I was like, well, let me look around in my area and see what I could find. And sure enough, there was a doctor in our area who specialized in doing that, because she had done this for veterans in the past. All she had was one paragraph mention of it on her website. And that's what drew me to it and started investigating it and went there and to actually have it done. And it was a real big game changer because so when you got PTSD or any kind of trauma, it could be sexual trauma from past relationships or whatever. It doesn't matter. The point is, when you have that trauma, there's two things that are going to happen. So the brain does the physical part, which is, you know, it triggers the body to respond to that triggering event. And then there's the psychological part where the brain itself is being triggered and it's going through its internal thinking and affecting your mood, your choices, decisions, everything like that. You got to address them both. So the SGB was the first one I'd heard about, and that's what I addressed first. And essentially what happens when you get that physical trigger, The nerve is on both sides of your neck here. And so what they do is they put like it's lidocaine or some other anesthesia directly on the nerve, and it kind of blocks that signal. So when your brain gets triggered, sends it down for your body to react, it gets blocked and bounces back and like kind of resets. And so that stopped the body. It stopped the fight or flight instance where you immediately tense up, go defensive, and you start, you know, getting real aggressive and with your words that you shouldn't be doing.
That clinch.
It stops that, or at least delays it quite a bit. So you have enough time to actually cognitively think about this before you say something to your significant other or your boss that's going to get you fired. Good at helping with that. But you still have to address the mind. And that's when one of my other writer friends, Jason Casper, he's got his own really good career going with his books that he does. He told me, I heard him do an interview and he was talking about ketamine therapy. And so then I reached out and asked him a little bit more about it. We talked on the phone, a couple emails, and told me about that. I was like, all right, you know what? I'll try this out too. So then again, researched around. I found another doctor in my local area who was, lo and behold, doing this to treat trauma and working with veterans. And I was like, all right. So I tried the ketamine therapy. And with that, what they do is it's a there's two ways you can do. You can either do oral, or you can do an IV. So I did the IV is the best one for the treatment. And the way he had it set up is we did three treatments 1 week, then three the next, so total six sessions. And then after that, it's just, you know, if you need it, tune up, so to speak, you know, because it's not gonna last for the rest of your life, but it gets you going, gets you started, and then it helps you kind of process and get through it, so these things aren't constantly hitting you and just, you know, over and over again. They start to not have their effectiveness anymore. So when you have PTSD, it's kind of like the synapses in your brain are just full of wires and stuff. They're damaged, okay? The incidents and things have caused them to not work properly. But when they do the ketamine therapy, it actually gives the brain like some time to actually heal, which is kind of a weird thing. I don't understand all the neuroscience of how all that stuff works. I just, it's what's been explained to me. We've got a video. I did a video with the Fox 13, I think it was local station here in Tampa, about doing the treatment, you know, and so they kind of videoed that to show how to do that. Same thing with the SGB, because I've been trying to get more veterans aware of this kind of thing, because it really does work. But the ketamine one, like that is so amazing, because they it's really weird, you know, people are afraid to try new things or don't know anything about it. So I just try to explain what it actually is, so that way I can remove some of those stigmas too, I suppose. But
yeah, well, not everybody. I mean, the general, you know, stereotype around ketamine is it's abused as a horse tranquilizer, and people, you know, basically abuse it to go trip. Now, when it's done in a therapeutic session, are you when you're under the drip, are you going for a ride, or is it like a low dose just to bring a stress level down or to achieve a certain level?
You're out. You're
just gone. Out.
You're gone. You're on the trip. You're going down Alice in Wonderland's little tunnel down to wherever you're going. So the way I explain it personally, how I've experienced it, is for me, it's literally like meshing the Matrix and I just forgot the Leonardo DiCaprio movie where
Inception.
Inception, yes. It's just freaking Inception for me. Wow. Because you have like one dream level, and then that morphs into like another one where you fall further in, and then it morphs to another one, you fall further in, and you get to a point you just don't know what's going on, like what's real almost. It's a very strange feeling in a way, but God, you feel better after that. And you sleep like the most sound sleep you'll ever sleep that night after that too. So what he does is he actually uses a benzodiazepine before he does that. So he puts your body into a very happy state, which is great, because if once they give you that and you're under, It's usually not very long. Sometimes you're under for between 20 to 30 minutes. You can be down much longer as well, but that's typically what it is or has been for me. But man, using the benzo before, it's a much happier experience because if you don't, if your mind's in a wrong spot when they hit you with that, and you're thinking bad, nasty thoughts when that thing hits, the trip you're going to get is not pleasant. And there's no, you just have to ride it out. You're out, I mean, you're unconscious. You're not moving or thrashing about or anything like that. But in your mind, you're like, oh my God.
I've had a couple trips. That was my next question.
I've had a few bad ones when I did the oral ketamine, like at home stuff. You know, you talk with the doctor and stuff on a telehealth thing, and they send it to you from a compounding agency. And then, you admit it, you do it with someone else, usually, nearby in case you need some help or whatever. But, you put those under your tongue and you just, it eventually hits you. Then you fall under. I don't like that version of it. It's a lot cheaper, but I don't like that version of it because it doesn't have the benzo. And so it doesn't set you up for a good trip per se. For me, it also took a hell of a lot longer to come out of it and to get back to like normal functioning. Because when I do the IV, 10, 15 minutes later, I'm good to go. Like I'm fully back to normal and recovered and feeling great. If I do the oral thing, I've got about like 30 to 45 minutes where before I can start to actually move my limbs so I can actually walk to use the bathroom and start to pull out of it. Like it takes me a good two hours sometimes, like get back to somewhat normal from that. Yeah. So I wouldn't personally recommend the oral one.
just makes me wonder like what's going on in there to kind of reset or, recycle everything, so to speak, to get the, cause I mean, it's an electrical unit. Like when I'm trying to just figure it out, and I know nothing about, nobody listen to me when we're talking about brains, but it's just a electrical signals flashing back and forth, which creates whatever this is, we are. But for the ability to go down that road and have it reduce the symptoms and the effects of trauma, did they ever even try to explain it to you, or do they even know? They just know that the efficacy.
Yeah, they try to explain to you. I mean, a lot of it is, again, your brain is full of neural synapses and links.
Yeah,
and that's how everything flows and moves. When those things get injured or damaged because of a trauma or different things like that, they start to create alternate routes around things so they avoid the trauma, whatever it is that's locked in this one spot. The ketamine helps to reestablish a lot of these things so that way the brain starts functioning in a more normal state instead of this PTSD or trauma-induced state that you tend to be in a lot. And because that is happening, you're not getting triggered as often or as much as you were before. And when you combine that with the SGB, you're really kind of helping to set yourself up to not have those triggering events on a regular basis or have them affect you like they used to. And so that's what's really important. But at the end of the day, you have to kind of accept and understand that this is not a fix-all. This is not going to fix you and restore you to 100%. It is, however, going to help you be able to cope and manage it with a lot more ease and success than nothing at all.
Yeah, to be able to understand when you're triggered, why you're triggered, and how to handle when you're triggered.
And because it's helped heal the body a bit, both the physical and the psychological side. When you are getting triggered from different events, it's not as bad as it used to be. You know, like if your thing was getting triggered by, gunshots or whistling from explosives, coming in, different things like that, you'll still hear it. You'll still think about some of those things, but they won't cause you to dive in a ditch. They're not going to cause you to tense up and look for cover or something like that. For me, a big trigger for me was smells, certain kinds of smells, because in the camps, we had 5,500 prisoners in a camp that had capacity of 2,000. So you can imagine what that thing smells like in the summer.
In Iraq.
Yeah, it's really nasty. It smells like it smells like dirty baby diapers.
All the time. So yeah.
For me, it was really hard with when all three of our kids were born, because I was constantly getting triggered by smelling that each time I would have to change them and do that. Or if I'm walking, like when I was in Chicago working at Ann, you know, walking past an alleyway where you have some of that smell from the trash that hasn't been picked up yet, and it kind of triggers you like that. So for me, this was really helpful because it helped me to be around that kind of material without having that triggering effect all the time. And it's helpful because at the end of the day, man, it's a lot to ask your family to put up with you when you have these kinds of problems or challenges like that. It's hard. You're going to lash out. You're going to be emotionally detached, and that's just difficult. It's no way to live life. And it makes their life miserable. It makes your life miserable. And you're stuck in this doom row, loop over and over and over again.
As much as they try, they can't understand it.
Why am I doing this? Why am I even here? Like, what's the point? And you start going down all those negative paths. But for me, writing was great because, again, it was an outlet to express myself and do all this. But then it became a business that I can actually make some pretty good money at and not feel like I'm a burden on my family or society because I can't function or do certain things. And it also gave me the ability then to look into these alternative treatments and try to fix yourself, better yourself, try to handle some of these things. Because, again, it goes back to, like, people are always like, oh, I don't want to be weak. I don't want to, seem like I'm giving in or whatever. The fact is, the people who are weak and the people who don't have that internal strength are the ones who continue to avoid it, the ones who continue to hide from it. They're not willing to just step up and address the problem. Say, you know what? I have a problem. Doesn't make me weak. I have a problem and I want to take it. I want to tackle this thing head on and I'm going to fix it. Or I'm going to try to do something to fix this issue and make it better. That takes way more guts and being brave to do that, because you're going to go up against really bad, debilitating thoughts and stuff in your headspace. And that's very hard to win against.
Yeah. But it's only going, there's no way to pull out yourself.
Your fortitude to just do it. That's what it takes. You start looking and you're like, man, I can do this. I can take this on. I can fix this and make myself a better person, or at least cope with this crap in a better, more positive manner that can help me and help my family. Because you don't want to be a burden on society. You don't want to be, woe is me and have, living in a freaking double wide or something like that. And now you're, trailer park life.
Getting over that stigma is that, like you mentioned earlier, like the assessment you had to go through post deployment, it's, the stigma's there no matter what, even though, you're required to go through these, you're afraid to say anything because command will drop you in a heartbeat. If it becomes a problem for them, there's that stigma's there. It's almost weird. They offer the route. But everybody knows from past experience and seeing other people take the route that they're gone. Stuff's taken away from you. And to get past that stigma, I think the agencies are doing better now at trying to remove that stigma. I know I work now, it's actually built into basic training to the needs. They actually go through the effects of stress and pathways of dealing with stress. And they make all that stuff available right from the jump. So maybe in a few years you can see that mm-hmm. payoff. But yeah, just getting people to get past that stigma and realize that you're actually making a positive step. You're not hurting yourself by trying to get help. And that's a tough one. That's a tough one to get past the culture. I think
it is to get past the culture that this is an okay thing to do. I mean, think about it from this perspective. If you're out doing PT or combative training or different things like that, physical stuff, and you you tear your meniscus in your knee, right? Can you live with that? Can you operate with that? Sure. But it's probably going to cause you some problems. Make you, yeah, it'll make you less effective at what you're doing. So we don't look at going and getting these physical injuries and different things taken care of as weakness or a problem. We do with psychological things. And the reason being is because it's not something that you can visibly see. Mm-hmm. But I think that they have done a better job of getting past some of that and trying to actually help make it better, so to speak. And again, I'm not going to say that it's made me, made me whole or fixed or anything like that. It hasn't. It has made it a little easier to cope, mm-hmm. To be able to figure out how to live with it in a better manner that's not as hyper destructive to people around me. I don't want my kids to grow up and their perception and memories of me as being this angry dad who barked at them all the time, or just wasn't the nicest person in the world, treated their mom like crap, had problems with jobs and different things like that, all because he was in the military or whatever, or blames it on the military. I don't want to be that person. And so you have to kind of bite some pride and some ego a little bit and accept that you're going to need some help from some others who can maybe help you move past that, cope with it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping our conversation here tonight helps some people make that step. I think it's incredibly important to hear, perspective like yours, just to get that person that and you can see it. You can see the spiral and you can see the stress. A lot of people miss the signs, but when you see enough of those cases, maybe they can't see it, but it's there and you telling your story they can be like, holy shit, I should probably call somebody, they're looking at the calendar being like, when's school let up? It's like, why am I wondering when school lets up? It's just to set that right time to make everything okay for everybody. And that self-justification, maybe somebody can be like, yeah, maybe it's okay.
I've seen that or done that, but I've, contemplated that myself.
Yeah. I can see some of your actions in them, hopefully.
Well, people, it's not enough people talk about it and not enough people explain the different procedures and how they work and whatnot. And so there's a lot of folks who just don't understand it well. Fear. It's just they don't understand it. And when you don't understand something, you tend to fear it or vilify it. And so this hopefully kind of takes some of that away and makes it in a better path for someone to try and experiment with something. Because I know I've helped several vets get into writing, like really actually understand the business side of writing. Because there's the creative side, there's the business side. You got to know both if you're going to make this your full-time gig and actually be good at it.
Yeah, and we were talking about that earlier. I did the opposite of you. I did the complete opposite.
So I've helped a couple of vets get into that. Like one of the guys I've been working with for like the last, 6 years? He was one of my beta readers way early on. And then when I moved back here to Florida, we met up because he lived like 20 minutes from me. And so I've been talking with him and he wanted to create his own memoirs of his time in Vietnam. He was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam and then got a battlefield commission, became an officer, and then was flying helicopters again. So he was there for 3 years doing that. Great story and stuff. But, he hadn't really contemplated how he could make it work. And so I got him into doing the writing, hooked him up with our editor and cover designer, and we helped him with plotting and building this whole thing out. And, here he is. He's 76 years old. He's got, I think it's 7 or 8 books under his belt now.
Wow,
and
that's awesome.
He's done great with it. And what really kind of helped me realize how impactful that was and how much that actually helped was when his wife had made mention of it to me, that she was thankful that we'd taken the time to do this with him, because she said that since he started doing this with me like 6 years ago, he's been like a completely different person. Like it's actually helped work out a lot of these different problems and issues for him and made him essentially have a new sense and purpose. And that sense and purpose, you know, it extends your life. Okay. When you have no hope and no future, no nothing like that, you tend to not last very long. And so this gave him a new sense of purpose. And, you know, he's written his, I think, 6 books in his Undaunted Valor series that he just, you know, he does really great with. And now he's taking on writing another series about one of the units that he was involved in that was at in Korea at the Chosin Reservoir. It's the army side of that story. Everyone knows the Marine side. Jeez. But do you actually know about the army brigades that were there that actually enabled a lot of the Marines to get out? And those units suffered horribly, like, you know, 50-60% loss rates. And so he's now, you know, working on some of those stories to kind of tell and do all that. You know, he'll be probably writing into his 80s. You know, he just loves it and doing it. But more than that, like, because we really showed him all the business side, he made some serious money. He was making, you know, he was hitting like $5,000-$6,000 a month in book sales with just a couple of books out. Because we showed him how to hit the right genre, to hit the right sections, how to do these different paths and make it all tie together business-wise. And it's been really neat to see how he does that and grows and builds that out. You know, because he retired as an 06. He's got two sons. One had retired as a 05, but his other son's an 06 right now. And, you know, had worked quite a bit with, like, Mark Milley and some of the other senior leadership. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's impactful because, you know, he's able to say, hey, you know, his son would share his books with the different people there. And they all knew mentors or people who were in Vietnam and could relate to all this kind of stuff. And it was just neat how he's able to share and build his audience like that. And it's helped his own sons kind of see, you know, what their own problems and challenges and issues themselves, you know, because they've been in long enough now where, you know, they participated either in first Gulf War and second one and a lot of the operations and things that have happened since. And so it's been impactful for them too. And that's just neat to see how that helped him. And that's when I decided, well, let me try and help a few other vets. So we started working with a few more and, you know, had some misses and some successes and things like that along the way with it. But the main thing is that we're helping to shine a light on that subject and that thing, trying to help other people realize that they too can get in on doing some of this. It's not as hard or insurmountable as you may think. Most veterans are pretty damn good at grabbing a bone and not letting go and just chewing that thing. So this is something you can really sink your teeth into and actually make work as a business.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun. Yeah, gives that path for.
Yeah, or if you don't need the money, you don't want, you're not trying to do the business side, at least you're getting your stories, your ideas out and sharing them with the rest of the world. And, you know, this is going to live on in infamy for, you know, generations to come. And books, they're there. You know what I mean?
Especially a story like that guy's going from Korea to Vietnam. It's wild. That's a whole lot of service and some pretty obscure situations.
What we've created, you know, we've been doing this now for, gosh, what, 8 years or something. And I look back at just what we've created, what we've done. We're on year 9 doing this now, I think. And, you know, we've got such a breadth of content that we've created and new stuff that's going to still continue to be created, you know, in another 5 more years, you know. I think we got 35 books or so that we've done, you know, in 5 more years, another pace of basically 3 to 4 a year, you know, maybe rocking out, you know, an awful lot of content, 50 plus books, maybe 60 books. And these are not like small, insignificant books. These are meaty tomes, 120,000 word books, they're, you know, 550 page, 600 page books, and thousands and thousands of reviews. Like, they've been read by a lot. I mean, we saw upwards of like probably 210,000 to 230,000 books per year. So on our own worldwide, that's a lot of books. That's impacting a lot of people in different things like that, which is what I want to do.
Yeah, and they're packed in there. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm in Into the Battle. Yeah, and the scene I wanted to mention was taking that carrier, taking that alien carrier. Mm-hmm. That scene with Royce going hitting the hangar and then moving on, that was dizzying action.
Yeah,
like it was just badass. And the way you finished it, that was just That was, I haven't read a scene like that in a while. Like I was I usually read before I'm going to bed, and I was like, son of a bitch, I'm not sleeping tonight. Like it was so visual and so just vicious. Man, that was just awesome. So
the key is, how do you create that? You got to be able to create that and do that. And, like we had, I can't remember if this is in book one or maybe even tail end of book two, where they had the Zodark that they had captured that they were interrogating, right? And then
with Halsey, with the Admiral. Yeah.
He breaks out, and then he's chasing, Halsey down that corridor, and it's like, oh my God, and then she's about to get killed when, the security guys end up lighting him up and taking him out. But it was like, that's a visceral scene. That's like, holy crap, this thing is real.
You could feel it in her. And that's a hard one to get across in the page, but man, you could feel the fear coming across. Like it was, she's not an admiral anymore. She's a prey animal.
We get further into the series. Yeah. We've got a few more that are kind of like that, but I think that's, you want things to be real without like over exaggerating things. Cause that's one of the things I think some writers will do is they want it to be too much blood and guts and gore. And I'm like, it's actually, that's not what you actually want to do. You want to have it more about the feeling, the internal feeling that they're feeling from this. Like, put yourself in their position. What would you be feeling, saying, and thinking? It's not the visual descriptions of, them, the enemy getting hit by, a bullet or a laser blaster. It's the gut feeling. That's what grabs people. They're like, oh my God, I can totally see this scene visually happening to me right now, and I'd be freaked out. And writing the battle scenes in too, where it's real. It's like, holy cow, like these scenes are like, I can picture that actually happening, because when you're in Iraq or Afghanistan, you had similar things. Well, that's how I come up with my own stuff, because I didn't went to Afghanistan. I spent a lot of years in Iraq. And so I take those experiences of what it was like to have rockets coming in and hitting your fob, and you have no control over it, no idea where it's going to happen, or a dud lands pretty damn close to duds on you.
And where you caught that, it wasn't a rocketed scene, but that helplessness, you had, you've got a certain group on the ground and they're just surrounded. There's nothing they can do. And it was the same feeling as just, okay, I'm going to go get breakfast, but, some idiot is about to fire off a 106 from a truck 3 miles away, and maybe it's got me, maybe it doesn't. Right. But I got to eat. I gotta need some coffee. Like, it's like, I'm just walking to breakfast, but I know of three different stories of people who didn't make it to breakfast because they happened to be in the exact wrong place at the exact wrong time.
Yeah. I had that happen to me one time where the rocket hit the right angle, hit that T-wall, and it broke the detonator tip off, is what the EOD guys told us. And so that sucker just went right down the T-wall, hit the, right into the dirt, and was burying itself in there. It didn't go off though. And me and my buddy, we're probably less than 100 feet from that sucker. We're like, holy crap.
That just happened. I was doing, homework. I was doing homework one night. I was doing my grad program while I was over there, just doing homework in my dorm one night, and wham, it hit, 106 hit the room next to me. It just,
oh wow.
Like, it's so close. You can't even, that high explosive, like you can't even hear it. Like you just feel it. And then I'm on the floor.
What the hell happened here?
So I had to like walk outside my dorm and I take a look. I'm like, holy shit, that was a good one. Like whatever Kuwaiti built this place, I'm very thankful for them.
Oh, is this during, were you over at the old Baghdad embassy?
The new one. It was the neck. Okay. Al Kindi. Yeah. And I'm just doing my homework one day.
That was a way better place, because the old one at the palace, you had all the chews and stuff out there, but there was no top cover. And so a lot of times come in and they hit, and it would take out 3-4 chews at a time because it'd come down and hit on top. And because they're all, the T walls kind of all like buckle them in like that, you get something in the middle,
it holds that pressure away. They dropped a 240 even at the new neck. They still had the contractor chews out in the back 40, and they dropped a 240 one night that made it through the roof, and it turned four of them inside out. And I mean the crater was like massive. No, it didn't kill anybody, but it that's a hell of a way to wake up. But yeah, it
no
was
joke.
Just so random, just absolute randomness.
I
could feel it in those books. Like I was like, yeah, I know that feeling. I know that feeling.
Yeah, 2010 was my last time I was there, and we had I was interviewing for a job at CENTCOM. I was praying to God I was gonna get that job, because I was like, I gotta get out of this place before I get killed. And we had one night they had a rocket come in. I think it was like a 240, and it hit the POL station. So I was at the man camp over, we were doing this embassy security. So it went from Blackwater to Triple Canopy. So I was with Triple Canopy. So we're still at the man camp over there. We hadn't moved over to the embassy just yet. And it hit one of the POL stations, fuel stations, maybe a couple miles away. Boy, when that hit, man, it not only was the big boom from the 240, it was a couple of fuel trucks going up with it at the same time. And that was a hell of a bang. And so I was like, good God, I got to get out of this place. I mean, it's good money, but it's like, it's not going to do any good if you're dead. And there was another time. Yeah, there was another time we had it where they packed this truck full of explosives and stuff. I don't remember how many thousands of pounds it was. And they hit one of the hotels that people are saying.
My buddy worked that case. Yeah, there was
a bus. It was 2010. It's just early 2000.
Lit up a bus. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like maybe February, I think, January, February. But that's like a hit. And like I was there just typing, talking to my wife, and that thing, wham, that sucker hit. Like next, I'm on my ass. And I'm going, what the hell? Like it wasn't close to us. It was a couple miles, but it was that concussive of a force and knocked everyone over. I mean, it was a bang, hell of a bang.
It's hilarious. But when we went over there for that particular trip, staying in the embassy, it was I was attached to an FBI task force, and so we had marshals, ATF, DCIS, me, a CID guy, and we're just, it's the morning, we're getting ready to go out and meet up with our counterparts, and we're just kind of hanging out near the admin building. Mm-hmm. And just the same thing. Well, bam, wide open. And we had just gotten there. So they were always like, first move, just get off the X, just whatever you got to do, just run. So we all five of us take off, just sprinting across this park, going into the admin building. And we get in there and we look around, and everybody is just like standing there watching the five idiots go racing across the parking lot. Everybody else there, they were so used to it. They're just like, that was like 2 miles away, guys. Like, welcome to the show.
I know, but like, that's what's so bad. It's like, you've been inundated with this so much that you hear these things and you're like, whatever, if it's got my mark, it's got my mark, and I'm not going to worry about it anymore. And these massive explosions go off and they don't faze you anymore. That's kind of bad, but that's the reality.
It was kind of funny for all these special agents to we get done and we're just like, oh, we're the only ones that thought that was scary. Okay.
Yeah.
Box checked.
Yeah, it was like, you guys are a bunch of wimps.
Exactly. They're like, welcome.
Yeah. You guys probably, did you guys go out with the Triple Canopy escorts and stuff like that? They probably were your escorts.
We were over with the NIA, and so that we just kind of bounced around. We could go wherever we wanted, so we just kind of had our own thing. So which made it kind of nice. There wasn't we had our own little fleet of stuff. So we had to run a lead. We'd go just take off and go do it. Usually it was, but more than anything, it was just meetings with other agencies and other people and stuff like that. So, but. But yeah, interesting times. Yeah. Hopefully not repeated, but I unfortunately think that will be repeated at some point. Yeah.
History repeats itself.
History unfortunately repeats itself. So.
I know, it's nuts. Yeah. But yeah, yep. I mean, it's kind of fun. What so before you wrap up and things like that, what other, as a reader, what other questions? So I'll ask it two ways. So one as a reader and then one as a writer. So as a reader, what do you enjoy about the books like that you've read so far? So you got through Into the Stars and Into the Battle. I don't know if you've read the thriller side, because they're all very, same style.
I started with Into the Stars, so
when you read the Monroe Doctrine, you're going to be having a lot of deja vu on that one, because you're like, wow, I'm watching it. But what is it that as a reader that you liked or disliked or want to see more of or thought was done really well, things like that, because that may draw the analogies for other people listening to this.
I'll tell you, as a reader, you kind of throw a rope-a-dope with Into the Stars, because we start off with the pirates, and then we move over to the military, and we don't come back to the pirates for a while. And so you start out with the pirates saying, okay, we just found our bad guys. This is going to be kind of fun. And then it's like, nah, that's not what we're doing. And, you know, you've got political tension on top of there, and you've got the expansion of humanity into the stars. And you're kind of, it feels like humanity's got a whole lot of resources, and they're not quite sure how to orchestrate all of those resources. And it kind of just feels like what we do, or at least what, it feels like American westward expansion in a little bit, that no idea really where we're going. We don't know how to use some of the tools that we've got, and we don't really know what we're going to do when we get there. And we have no idea what's waiting for us. Let's just go. And then the blurb's going to tell you something on the backside, but when you get there, the way it's laid out, it could very easily have been, oh, I've seen this playbook before, and it didn't go that way. So that's what kept me going. And as you introduce characters, I mentioned Halsey, I can't think of the pirate's name off the top of my head. Their dynamic is a great story in and of itself. And then you've got Royce, the Delta, and you've got Hunt, who's the way you laid out Hunt was very easy to appreciate, because you start with him, and I don't want to give spoilers away, so this is all I'm going to say. The sacrifice he makes, he sacrifices his family, but he explains that he's been sacrificing his family for his entire career. And he does it again and again. And you can feel it. Like, you could tell how many times that you've left your wife to go on deployment. Yeah. Like, you could just feel it. Yeah. Yep. And as you're writing it, it's like, this isn't somebody who works in a comic book shop that just made all this up. This is somebody who said goodbye on a jetway before, you know? So that's, that authenticity is there. That will keep people coming back. And then as a writer, I enjoy the world. Cause I just got into the sci-fi game and I'm having so much fun. If I come up with a question of how I want to do this, I can absolutely make it up. It's just like, this is fun. I'm like, hey, what do I want my spaceship to look like? Whatever I want. Cause we don't know how physics works. the freedom to write in that genre. Yes. Yeah. And I've gone down the rabbit hole of exploring the merits of FTL versus hyperspace. You know, the Enterprise travels one way, the Battlestar Star Galactica travels another. Do I want bullets in my world, or do I want blasters? And it's like, I can do whatever I want. I can have both.
That's how we end up eventually doing it, because we start out with what we know, which is kinetic energy weapons. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're looking at, you know, mag rails and missiles, and we have some lasers, but the directed energy weapons, they're not powerful enough to hit targets, you know, the million plus kilometers away, because space warfare is actually largely in real life, space warfare is largely going to be extremely boring, very long, and conducted over very, very long distances. So you could fire something and it could take hours before it's actually going to get there and impact, and you're having to deal with all of that. So there's a lot of tension in doing it. It's very, I would say it's extremely reminiscent of like submarine warfare more than anything else. Because like in Battlestar Galactica and Star Trek and Star Wars, you got, these ships are like almost all on top of each other, firing their lasers. They do that for cinematic purposes. But in real world, it's going to be a lot more like submarine warfare, where it's done sniping and done from long ranges and things like that. One of the things I never understood from a lot of the writers is, I've read a fair bit of sci-fi, but they never incorporated like electronic warfare in the cyber aspect. And that's huge, because you can't lock on to a target to, you know, destroy it with your mega laser if you can't detect them, if you can't lock onto them, and because the signals are all being jammed up. Likewise, if you're using drones to go out to attack enemy warships, unless you got some really good encryptions on these things, they could actually be hacked and turned around and used on you. Mm-hmm. You know, we're seeing like that kind of tech taking place in Russia and Ukraine right now with their war. And so it's an interesting dynamic of how you got to interweave it all together to make it somewhat believable. Because again, you're not, like, I am not a hard sci-fi fiction writer. I try to write it using some basic logic and common sense and kind of quasi-real as I can. But I never claim to be a hard sci-fi guy because I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I try to keep it, keep it simple, stupid, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And go to research when you need it. But yeah, and one more thing, because I don't want to give spoilers away, but I think there was a really very unique perspective that I don't think we've ever seen, at least definitely not in sci-fi movies, but the Rook, when it all goes down with the Rook, Captain Hunt is suddenly standing there and he's in the middle of a pitched battle with multi different facets and many alien ships all trying to kill him at the same time. And he's sitting on a tin can. He has no idea what's going on. It's all just a tomb silent. And he's got to wait and hope that the power comes back on to figure out what happened to his ship. And it's
yes,
the helplessness there. I don't think anybody's ever bothered to write that, but you know, it's like, oh, I'm swinging for the fences right now. And oh, I'm not swinging for anything. I'm floating in space waiting for people to kill me. And there's nothing I can do about it.
And then the dynamic of when they crash down and they're ejecting from the pods and just trying to get out alive, they all descend down. They're now in this kind of like marshy bog area where the enemy is now out there. And they can hear them. And the enemy is doing its own psychological warfare, taunting them.
Oh, yeah.
We're coming for you. We're getting you. And every now and then, one or two of his spacers get you know, pulled off, you know, get snatched. And then they're, like, horribly killed on the side. And they're having to sit here and listen to it. And they're just, like, praying to God that a rescue effort is going to get there before they all die. And they've got limited weapons to try and fire back with and try to fight with because they're not fighters. You know, they've gone from this position of being in this warship to now they're on the ground going, oh my God, how are we?
This is not my job. This is not my job. This is their job.
Yep. And then the dramatic.
Not your job, but it's your problem.
You get the dramatic scene when the Deltas come over and you've got, you know, you've got Hunt, you got Brian Royce and his team. They're just jumping out of the backs of the Ospreys, hitting the dirt, and they're just full bore, you know, assaulting these Zodiacs like they don't have a care in the world because this is their world. And they're just, you know, blowing past the defenders. They're like, they're just trying to stay alive. And these guys are like, oh, no, we're bringing the fight to the enemy, and they're hunting them. And it's a
big deal. And that's. That's the part where I'm at now. Like, we just recovered from that. So that's right where I'm at. And that's, I'm a horribly slow reader. I have to read a book a week for the podcast, but, so there's the book of the week for the podcast. And then yours when I'm trying to go to sleep and then you keep me up all night.
You only get better. That's the trick of the writer. Yeah. You're going to do a deep series. You're only as good as your last book. And so you got to find ways to continue to draw them in and make it better and finish more of the story, more of the onion. Cause I like in every book and series, it's like an onion. You're just unwrapping layer after layer after layer. And the thicker the onion is like that, it's just more neat, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Well, that's and you hard. Said that Clancy was one of your influences. And I mean, there's a lot of Clancy in the plots. I mean, just the way they're organized. So
yeah,
for sure.
That three-layer organization structure I have is I follow that with all the books I write. It's just, you know, you have the command decision layer up top, you know, president, national security council, things like that. You got the next level, which is, you know, the Pentagon defense guys, your division, brigade commanders. And then you got the third level where it's now down to like the squad, the platoon, the company, maybe a battalion, and that's it. And so you get that dynamics where you have all these different layers, you know, sprinkled throughout the whole book. It ties it really nicely together without making it just a long, boring space opera book with little action or all action, and you don't know why or what's happening around
the
it. Why is this happening? How does it fit in the bigger picture? What else has evolved? what other tech's involved, what other ships and things that you don't get any of that stuff when it's all action like that.
Yeah. Violence so, just for violence sake. Violence. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, man, I'm looking forward to the next ones. I have a feeling I'll be working on those, that series throughout the summer. So yeah. I'll have to have you come back and keep talking about it.
Summer. Yeah. I'm trying to get book 10 out by end of May, early June. And then, I don't know if we can, but the goal is to try to wrap up it's 12 books in total. So the goal is really to wrap up the last three books this year. If not, then to get the final book wrapped up by no later than January, February next year at the latest, because we're going to go into the next series after that is going to be that bridge series where mm-hmm. we have the AI war we talk about in the sci-fi series of how it kind of almost ended humanity. We're going to go back and do that AI war. We'll be it's another series. And then that also ties in with the Monroe Doctrine, because in that one.
Yeah, what a great idea.
Yeah, Jade Dragon is defeated, but maybe not. And so
that's
interrupt a little bit and bridge them together and ties both series, both genres together.
Yeah, that's going to be like you said earlier, you know, if we're not pushing the genre, if we're not pushing the next level and tying in a thriller series straight through, you know, making it over 100 years of humanity, but throughout the same series, that's going to be something different. It's going to be great.
Basically, these three series will start in 2023. And they will stretch into the early 2120s. And so that's going to be the timeline. It's going to be 100 years of history, basically, of armed conflict throughout the times and the evolution of that whole thing, which is just going to be really going to be neat to see how that all comes together. It's just, it takes years to build, though, because you're going.
That's going to be a big world. Yeah, that's going to be a lot going on there. The fun part is getting
some of the spinoff series going, too. Like, we've mm-hmm. got a spinoff series that's going to start real soon where we're going to be following a ship captain as he kind of rises through the ranks, a drone pilot, an Osprey pilot, and how they're, I don't know if we figure out if we're going to have it as friends or if we're all relatives and family related and just different tracks of it. So they're going to enter, that series will start with the beginning of the Intus campaign. So right as probably right around book three's timeline.
Cool.
And then we'll follow that for about 12 book series, basically all the way through to where the current main series will end. And we'll see their whole progression and career go through. And then we have another one we're going to follow one of the battalions or one of the brigades from the 101st Airborne. And so it's the Rakasan battalion. Mm-hmm. So our brigade, we're going to follow them in their progression from when the war started and all sort of through it. So then you're going to get to see other little campaigns that were mentioned in the main series but not talked about. You're going to get to see it from a whole new lens and idea and perspective. And then even, like I was sharing with you earlier, the Interstellar Marshal Service and how these guys are essentially trying to recreate and build a counterintelligence apparatus to stop the Macabre from being able to infiltrate, you know, their own spies and sabotaging missions to hurt the war efforts and things like that, tie it all together and have it all part of one big series, but with all these different spinoffs on the side, that's going to be really kind of neat to see how it all comes together and works. And
yeah, that's going to be an industry. That's going to be great. Yeah.
Be fun. A lot of fun to write.
Absolutely, man. But I had to do it because I have a feeling we could probably talk all night, but I got a couple of little fellas. I got to get ready for school in the morning. Yeah, you got the same thing. But no, we got to do this again. So I guess come June, whenever book 10 comes out, I definitely will not have gotten there yet, but come back. We can talk about it more.
Sounds good, man. We'll talk to you later. Thanks for allowing me. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for offering your story like that. I think it can really help people, and I think it's very important to see not only the way you've dealt with it and learned to cope, but also open that door for people who are not quite ready to make that turn yet. That might help them reach. So
that's a big thing.
I appreciate it, and like I said, we'll talk again whenever you're ready.
Sounds good, man. We'll talk to you
later. All right, man. We'll talk to you later. Good night, everybody.